Welcome, everybody. We are back with the Star Electric College Basketball Podcast. I am Brendan Prunty, here as always with Mike Vorkunov in the Star Electric's studio in the back of the room.
The closet studio.
And we are here for, I think we can call this the fourth podcast. We filmed the third. If, for those of you who were wondering what happened to the podcast last week, we filmed it with the great John
Sutton. No, this is the fifth one.
No.
We had Brady McCullough, we had Ballin as a Habit Guys, we had the first one, which was just ourselves.
Okay, that's right, yeah.
And then we had the podcast that doesn't exist.
That's right, okay, so, yeah, if you're wondering, the podcast that doesn't exist was John Solomon of PrinceOfBasketball.com, was great enough to come on with us last week.
And we failed him.
And give us a good, solid 15 to 20 minutes of his time, and we just stunk. And the editing froze, and we lost the podcast, so... We are back. Plenty to talk about, so we should probably get started right away. What hit you from this weekend?
Is that a pun?
You know what? I guess it is.
I guess, you know, obviously...
We should start there.
The most obvious... That was pretty good.
I didn't even mean to.
you know, I think the most obvious thing was the Cincinnati Xavier brawl.
Yeah.
And then Two Holloway.
You know, yeah.
I'm with him. They're just thugs. You know, they don't give in, and that has got to be like the gaffe of the year. And how do you? Somebody was saying this, and I agree. We know college kids are like overly PR'd by, you know, by your SIDs and everything, and they won't let you say anything.
Right.
How do you not tell them, hey guys, contrition, shut up, and that's it. That's all you can say out there.
Yeah, it's apparently too the zip 'em up is their motto.
Uh huh.
Because, you know, when they were showing the clips of the fight, you see kids in the stands with zip 'em up signs. So I started thinking, well, that's really quick. I mean, that kid is, you know, is just either expected it to happen or what. But, you know what? I think I made this point on our blog Monday afternoon, the shoot around. Is I think the suspensions, with the exception of Holloway, I thought should have gotten to at least another game or two because. He's Two Holloway. He's an All-American candidate. He's the Conference Player of the Year. You know what? If you look at the entire tape, he is the guy. He's not fighting, but he is, you know, always he's chirping. He's jawing with the rest of these guys. And you know what? You don't want to say he's the instigator, but he certainly wasn't putting the fire out. And then, obviously, he was right in the middle of shoving, what was it, Guwan Glynn? Is that how you say the guy's name?
There.
The Cincinnati guy at the end of the game, which started everything. So I think all the suspensions were warranted. Here's my only problem. They don't hit any of the teams where they hurt. And in college, you clearly can't penalize guys. You can't suspend them. Can't give them a $50,000 fine because they don't make money.
Right.
So you hit them where it hurts.
You take away
their games against Wright State, Chicago State. I mean, are you serious? They're playing a team that's 0-9. Yancey Gates is going to miss a game against a team that's 0-9.
Well, I was going to say, look.
That's not a punishment.
For some
reason. That's a reprieve.
For some reason, like, conferences and coaches are under the idea that all games are created equally.
They're not.
No, they're not. You know the games they're missing? They're missing Wright State, Radford. I don't even know what the initial. I can't tell what the next one is. Chicago State, Oklahoma, and then Pittsburgh is the one Big East game they miss. And then the Big East goes out and they say, yeah, you know what? We're cool. We're good with what Mick Cronin and Cincinnati decided to do. Why? Why are you cool with that?
Yeah.
Why are you okay with them missing one game?
Here are the records of the teams: Yancey Gates and the three other guys that are suspended for six games from Cincinnati are going to miss. They're going to miss Wright State 4-6, Radford 3-8, Arkansas Pine Bluff 1-5, Chicago State 0-9, Oklahoma 7-1, and at Pittsburgh 9-1. There is two games of consequence. In that schedule.
That's all I heard.
That's the thing. Here, and if they miss, listen to this. If they were actually suspend them for Big East play, conference games are worse. Essentially, they're double regular games. Okay, so you're not only a loss in your conference, it's a knock against you for the NCAA tournament. A loss against Chicago State is not because if you beat Connecticut, you can recover.
Right.
If Cincinnati suspended Yancey Gates for six games, and I'm going with Yancey Gates here because he's the guy at the forefront of all this. You know, he was the guy who punched Kenny Freeze in the face, then threw another punch later on after people were restraining him. These were the games he would miss if he missed the first six games of the Big East Conference. At Pittsburgh, Notre Dame, St. John's, at Georgetown, Villanova, and at Connecticut.
Now that seems like a punishment.
That is a punishment. You want to get someone to not do this again? You suspend him for those games.
And I think somebody made a great point. LeGarrette Blount, the running back for Oregon, when he punched the guy after the game.
Right.
It wasn't a punch that started a melee, mind you. He missed 10 games. 10 football games.
Yeah.
Which is a whole season, basically. Yancey Gates, in the middle of a Royal Rumble on the court, you know, there's a Royal Rumble there, is missing six games.
Yeah.
He's missing four games.
I wasn't on board with the people who said, well, they should be suspended for the season. They should, you know, there shouldn't be allowed to. I think that's too hard. I think that's too hard. You know what? Both, if this was one guy going after another guy and no one else was involved, then maybe you can talk about 10 games, 12 games, 15 games. This was granted, Yancey Gates was the guy throwing punches, making guys' eyes bleed, whatever.
That dude was scary.
Both teams were involved. Everyone was in on it. You got walk-ons, you got part-time guys, you got starters. Everyone is in on it. I think the amount of times were fair. The games missed was not. I think if you really want to send a strong message to the rest of the league, to the rest of, you know, the team, the rest of the country, that this type of stuff is not tolerated, you suspend it for conference games.
See, this is just, I feel like we're just screaming into the ether right now, because this is my problem with college sports. They missed six games for this. Festus Ezeli missed six games for what? For some kind of NCAA infraction.
Right.
You know, the guy from NC State, I forget his name.
Tim Abramidis missed four
Tim
games.
Tim Abramidis missed four games because he played in an exhibition as a right. sophomore when he's being redshirted.
Yeah, there's...
You can miss eight games for having cream cheese on your bagel, as Jay Bills points out on Twitter every single day.
Yeah, you...
It's stupid.
Yeah, it's... There needs to be a better system of, you know what, you do this, it's worth this games. You do that, it's worth this amount of games.
They just need to find some common sense.
There needs to be, like, a fine line between punishments for violations, punishments for... fighting for insubordination, whatever you want to term it. There needs to be a better definition, a fine line there.
It's just why you can, college sports in itself, you know, on the field, on the court is great, but whenever it goes out into kind of that bureaucratical realm, it becomes a sham mockery of itself. It's just ridiculous. And I think this is just the latest example of that.
Yeah. Well, we, again, we don't want to spend too much time on fighting. We're going to get right to our very special guest this afternoon. We have with us Dana O'Neill of ESPN.com. She does a wonderful job, you know, across the country, locally, Big East, A-10, you know, she's everywhere. She does all sorts of great things for them. So we're pleased to have Dana O'Neill. Like, we'll start off with, you know, the big win over the weekend. You were at Indiana and, you know, for Indiana, Kentucky. I mean, just, well, for someone who wasn't there, who only got to witness it on TV, what was that atmosphere like during and after?
Crazy. I mean, you have to understand, that was the first time I've ever been to a game at Assembly Hall. I may not go back. Just retired on that one. So, you know, it was crazy. We got there, students were lined up waiting to get in. Obviously, they've been there since 7 a.m. And it was fever pitch from the minute I walked in the building. And I'm thinking, like, can they endure this? And honest to God, they did. I mean, it was loud. It was on edge, and of course, when Kentucky's making its comeback, it was pretty, you could sense almost a universal feeling of dread. But it was fantastic. I've been to a lot of great atmospheres. I can't think of one that rivals this from start to finish in the last 10 years. And at the end of the game, I mean, it was just bedlam, but it was happy bedlam. It was joyful, and it was just, people didn't want to leave. Old people were just standing in the stands watching. Kids were going crazy. I picked up my computer at one point thinking, all right, well, I'll just try to meander to the press room now. And some woman behind me goes, you don't really think you're getting out of here, do you? No, not really.
Dan,
they want to stay forever, given the chance.
I was going to ask, I don't know what the media setup is at Assembly Hall, but were you in that whole mess of people on the floor? Could you get out? What?
No, you know, we were up like we were sort of like above the scorer's table. We had a really great view of midcourt. We were above the scorer's table. We weren't courtside, so I wasn't in the stampede. But to get out, you had to kind of go down these steps and through the court, at least like along the side of the court, to get to an exit so you can kind of walk through the bowels of Assembly Hall to get there. And you couldn't. I mean, you just couldn't do that. We waited a good 20 minutes, maybe 15, 20 minutes before even trying to get out. And even then, it was just like, okay, this is going to take a while. So, yeah, I wasn't in the melee. It's actually funny because I got a text from my husband, "Are you okay?" So I wasn't in the middle of it, so I was okay.
Now, you said that. I mean, I like to spin off that for a second. I mean, what is the best arena you've been to? I mean, you know. I mean, is there anything comparable to that? I mean, I know it's hard when the place is you beat number one and it's Indiana, but I mean,
on a buzzer beater, right? You know, I've been to obviously there's a lot of really cool arenas that I've been to. A lot of great atmosphere. I mean, I was at the Duke Kentucky game when Christian Laettner hit the shot. I mean, for a moment in college basketball, you're never going to top that. But that was an NCAA tournament game, so you right. didn't get that one-sided, crazy, ferocious atmosphere. You know, you can go to a great game, and you can always go to Kansas and see a great game just because when they get the Rock Chump Day off going, it's really cool. I've been to a lot of great Big Five games at the Palestra where it's been as crazy and as nasty. And, you know, I did the Princeton-Penn game when Princeton had, like 7 points or something and came back and won. But honestly, just for a fever pitch, and the meaning behind it, because I think that was a lot of it, too. You know, God, these Indiana fans have been waiting a long time for something to celebrate. And it's not like this is some, like, fly-by-night program that suddenly got good. This is a program that was really great for a long time and then fell apart. So this was just, they've been waiting for this for a long time. I would be hard-pressed to match it.
Yeah, that was the thing that kind of struck me about that whole win, was that it, like you said, it was a happy feeling afterwards. Because I didn't even realize... I mean, I knew Indiana had been down for a while, but until I read, you know, the Indianapolis Star story where, you know, they hadn't been ranked since March, I think, 3rd of 2008. I mean, you think about Indiana, and then you think about that stretch, and it's kind of mind-boggling in a way.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. I mean, they hadn't beaten a top-10 opponent in I forget how many years. I mean, Cream was 0-10. He was 0-4 against top-10 opponents. They beat maybe two top-25. And last year, they stormed the court for heaven's sake, and they beat Illinois because Illinois was ranked. I mean, that doesn't usually happen at Indiana. They don't usually court storming for beating Illinois. So, yeah, it's been a really long time. And you have to remember, too, the context of it. I mean, Indiana, along with fighting itself from being a great basketball program, always in itself on being clean of NCAA violations. And so everything just sort of went down the toilet with Kelvin Sampson. And I think a lot of people were worried if it was going to come back with Cream. This is sort of like the hot seat year for him. He got Cody Zeller. Could he actually do it? And so it was, I think, a huge like relief as much as a celebration for everybody involved.
Right.
Dana, going back to the environment there at Assembly Hall, because I think that was... not as much as the win, but close to part of the story there. And it seems like you had a lot of fun. What's the most fun you've ever had, you know, covering a game or just working on any story that you've done?
Wow, that's a hard question. I've had a lot of really great experiences. I mean, I've had some wild ones. I mean, one of my first assignments when I joined ESPN.com was to go on a bus with Alcorn State through HBCU world of no man's land. We were in Arkansas, all over the place. And that was, I think it was kind of depressing at some level because you just saw how difficult it was for these schools to compete with so little, but it was so much fun because sitting on a bus with the basketball team and eating at food courts. You know, I mean, it was crazy. And I've done a lot of wacky things. I mean, I can't even, actually when I was at the Philadelphia Daily News riding on the back of a motorcycle for the bike race in Philly, which was not basketball related, but it was wild. So there's been a million, the aircraft carrier this year, that was pretty cool. But, you know, this one was just like, I don't know, it was just such a neat feeling. As one of those games where at first we weren't sure if I was going to go, and honestly, God, if I was sitting home watching that on television and my editors had decided not to send me, I would have just been, like, shooting a dirty email for hours because I was furious. Because it was just so cool. I mean, I told Tom Crane after the game, like, I can't ever see anything quite like that before. Yeah. I mean, and then he saw the videos of downtown Bloomington, which... If you haven't seen them, go watch them. There's a video of a student that made it a bar called Nick. And it's so crazy. Like, I had a video camera on the big screen TV as the game is going on in the final seconds. And it's sort of like this, and then it's a scream. And then Watson's shot goes in. And then his camera goes all over the place. Because, you got... It's just hilarious. It's amazing what what that town felt like.
Yeah. It was, you know, speaking of stories, you did a piece. I know this is kind of a hard veering to the right, but you did a piece a couple weeks ago up at Syracuse. Everyone knows how difficult the Bernie Fine situation has been up there. The story you did on the victim's home was just absolutely, I mean, if you haven't gone to read it, you know, you should. Can you at least just tell us, like, you know, how difficult that was? Or, I mean, was it, you know, is it one of those, as reporters, we're always trying to, you know, separate ourselves from the story, but I imagine that was pretty difficult in that situation.
Yeah, it was. I mean, they, you know, I'd asked the people at your house to see if they could hook me up with a survivor to speak to them, and they called me, actually the night before I was at the Syracuse Eastern Michigan game and said that they had four, and that I could meet them the next day. And so part of me, you know, like, yeah, cool, I got it. It's going to be great stuff. And then I kind of stepped back and I was like, wow, this is going to be heavy stuff. And I'll be honest, when I walked into that room and I just saw four men sitting there, I was really intimidated. Mm-hmm. Not frightened, but, you know, just sort of like, I just felt like, you know, this is none of my business. You know, am I being fine? Is this wrong? But they made me feel really at ease at first because they made it clear that the reason they were sitting there, because why they felt it was so critical to tell their story, is that because people weren't educated enough. They didn't understand that this happened, that this is how it happened, that there's a reason men don't come out for 20 to 30 years to say, thinking that these people who are blaming the victims and calling them liars, this is why they're wrong. So, you know, it was one of those situations where I just asked simple questions and they talked.
Yeah.
And that just seemed to be the best way to handle it, because especially, you know, and I kept saying to them, look, I can't possibly put myself in your shoes. I don't even know what to say. So they kind of led the conversation, and I thought that was the right way to do it. And they were just so open and so appreciative. I got emails from all of them the next day saying, you know, thank you for telling our story. And I said, well, geez, you know, thank you for sharing it, because that takes more courage than I could ever muster. So it was pretty, certainly, as I said to my editor at the end of it, that's certainly the most powerful thing I've ever been a part of. Like, you know, you're doing something important, but you're a little scared to do it, too, at the same time.
Yeah, it was, like I said, again, that was absolutely just a tremendous tremendous piece. And if you haven't read it, go do it.
Thank you.
And then, in what will most obviously be a horrible segue, Syracuse was named number one this week. And it was, it's been kind of a good week for the Big East. They've been named number one. They added five teams officially last week. And I was just wondering, we've heard a lot about what it's going to do for football and the effects of just hopefully saving them and their AQ status and all that. But there's a basketball side to all of this. And you're adding, Houston, SMU, and UCF for basketball in a conference that's losing Pittsburgh, Syracuse, and West Virginia. What does it mean for the Big East and the basketball side of things?
Well, it's certainly not a fair trade. I mean, I don't think you take, you know, those three teams out and add those other three. I mean, James Dickey for Jamie Dixon and Bob Huggins for Matt Doherty. You know, I don't think that's a straight-up trade for anybody. my concern through all of this has been, you know, that to me, the Big East, in my opinion, somewhere along the way lost its way. I understand what they're doing financially. I understand why they're doing it to remain competitive in football. But to me, the identity of the Big East always associated first and foremost with basketball, it's who they were, it's who, what they were, you know, founded on, and who people identified with. I mean, I don't think most people used the word Big East thought of, yeah, great football, you know, at Rutgers, or, yeah, you know, go UConn football. That's not what they think. They think about basketball. And instead of looking at that as being the most viable company they had, they decided to kind of go all in on football, and to me, it's at the expense of basketball. You know, John Marinato said in his teleconference that teams have had a way of elevating their game once they join the Big East. Well, you know, I don't think DePaul or South Florida is saying that right now.
No.
And I just don't see what that does. So you basically see we're adding crummy teams in the hope that they get better, but you're still watering down what's been a really great product. So I understand that they were hamstrung, they lost three schools. My argument would have been, you know what, the heck with the football, we can't compete here. You're not even adding great, other than Boise, I mean, what are you adding football-wise? It's not great football out there. I mean, Boise's good, Central Florida's all right. Houston, I know, is great this year, but are they going to continue now that they've lost their coach and their quarterback? I don't know. So why not say instead, go get some great basketball programs. I mean, you can go with the footprint of what you've got and add more great Catholic schools. You can add St. Louis. You can add Mr. Eaton. And, you know, Richmond, if you don't want to go outside of the Catholic footprint. So our school, you could make it a great basketball league again. Instead, you made it an average basketball league and an average football league.
Yeah.
Well, that's my little pulpit.
I think that's the perfect point, because I mean, you look at now. I mean, who's excited to watch Big East basketball in the Garden when it's the championship game could be Central Florida versus, you know, DePaul?
Who's excited to watch Big East football?
And the biggest, you know, some of the players have a great, you know, you're talking about rivalries within the Big East and the football front, kind of pump up South Florida, Central Florida. Really?
Yeah.
And that's the best you got to do with football. That's the best you're doing, this to get the Central Florida, South Florida rivalry going in the Big East, by the way.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, we will. We've had every guest come on before they leave. We asked them to give their final four picks and national champion. Now we know each guest who gets closer to the end of the season gets a more upper hand. But we have people on the board with Kentucky, Carolina. You know, the usuals. Are yours any different from what we've been hearing?
Well, probably not. I would argue right now that, to me, the most complete team and the team that I would back as the national champion leader right now, presuming Jared Sullinger is healthy, is Ohio State.
Mm-hmm.
I just think I have the fewest questions about them of all the teams. You know, I know North Carolina is wickedly talented, but I always wonder about sort of their gumption, for lack of a better word,
right,
and their defense. So they're the team that I would sort of back right now as the front runner for a national title. I would add as maybe a wild card team that's looking like it could be the UConn of last year, the Final Four contender, is Missouri. I think they look terrific.
Yeah.
I mean, I really love the way they're playing. I thought they'd be a mess without Lawrence Bowers and with all the offseason issues, but I really love the way they're playing right now, and I would not be surprised at all if they were in the Final Four. If you'd asked me 4 days ago, I would have said maybe Xavier, but now I'm a little bit on the fence about that one.
So, they've got a fighting chance.
But as a deep, you know, sleeper team.
Well, who's your pick for the overall
national champion?
Yeah.
I say right now it's Ohio State. Can I change it next week?
Yes. Believe me, our first episode, I picked Carolina, and our second episode, I wanted to change it to Kentucky.
Yeah, so that's kind of how it usually goes. If you
want to
ask me on, like, March 30th, I'll be pretty
confident. Yeah,
right now, I mean, I would lean Ohio State, because unless, you know, with the asterisk, of course, that, you know, Jared Sullinger does not have serious back issues.
Yeah.
Assuming he does not, that would be my pick right now. That was not my pick at the beginning of the season, however, of course, now it is.
Well, Dana, we appreciate a nice chunk of your day, especially during the busy part of the season, and hope to have you on again soon.
You bet, anytime. I'm glad to do it.
Thanks, Dana.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Take care.
Bye. Well, that was great. I mean,
she was awesome.
Yeah, she was, you know.
I don't think she has four teams, though.
I think she threw in Kentucky and Carolina. I think everyone assumes that you go Kentucky, Carolina,
okay.
and then they're, everyone. We should ask everyone to just essentially give a final two pick now.
Because I'm, like, looking at her, and I'm like, there's two teams. I have Ohio State and Missouri. That's only two.
Yeah. I she mentioned Carolina and Kentucky in there, I think, in passing. I think everyone just assumes that they start with those two teams now, so which will be hilarious to everyone in America when those two teams probably don't make the Final Four now. You know what? Yeah, like I said, the Final Four pick, yeah, it was good. I wouldn't have thought of Missouri, but they are playing
very
well.
That's why she gets paid the big bucks.
Yes.
Missouri's looked pretty good.
Yeah.
And I think that they came out of nowhere. But
they did.
Well, not relative anonymity.
Right, obviously. Right. I think a lot of people thought Frank Haith would have a bigger problem there than clearly. I mean, he's everyone had problems with Frank Haith at Miami, and it's a new Frank Haith in Missouri. So whatever he's doing, it's certainly working. We want to switch gears, though. Obviously, this is the point in the show where we go local. Rutgers, Seton Hall, both teams off until the weekend. Rutgers doesn't play until Saturday afternoon at noon,
Stony Brook
at Madison Square Garden.
Seawolf.
And then as part of a blistering doubleheader with Fordham and St. John's.
Chris Gaston. And
so
that's it.
Yeah. And then, you know, Seton Hall plays Mercer at Sunday at noon, so.
Wait, before, can we backtrack 1 second?
What's up?
How does that foursome happen at Madison Square Garden? And who doesn't lose money on it?
Well, it's I it, the way someone put it to me actually yesterday, because I actually asked someone about that, but
Because that it's
St. John's always obviously is in the
right.
tournament, and then there's usually another marquee local mid-major team that's in the second game. And St.
So is
John's,
Rutgers that mid-major marquee
no,
team?
I think this, I think the mid-major team is Stony Brook, and they happen to just schedule. I think
Okay.
they want, I think essentially what you're going to see now with this Holiday Classic is the people at Madison Square Garden like Rutgers, and they want to have them at the Garden more, so they're figuring ways to get them in where they're not playing, you know, St. John's or a team like that.
Because these tournaments, like the Legends Classic, they just look like a lot of sunk cost.
Yeah.
There's no one there. It has to be for TV money that someone loses
Yeah, I
money
think it's
along
the
the way.
TV and advertising money, because if you think about it, I mean, you're staring at all you're not looking at the arena
No.
during the picture. You're just looking at the giant Reese's logo at center court, or the giant Aeropostale or whatever. So but I think that's how you get Rutgers Seton Hall, I mean Rutgers Stony Brook at the Garden. But
Okay.
and then St. John's generally always tries to schedule an opponent that they can beat.
Although they
And
couldn't beat Fordham last year.
they exactly. Well, yeah.
And
I
there's
I from what I've heard, Fordham is bad Fordham team for even by Fordham standards. I haven't seen them.
Well, I was up there earlier. They're young.
Yeah.
I was up there before the season. They have Chris Gasson, but he's down from where he was last year at least. Also
Right.
because they're trying to play him less minutes. But they're really young.
Yeah,
Like
right.
they brought in so many
And they
freshmen.
and you know what, to Tom Pecora's credit, I mean, you know, they really didn't have much when
But they're 6-3
he came in.
already. Or I think not 6-3, but they already have more wins this year.
Right.
I don't know why I thought 6-3, but I think they already have more wins this year than they did
Yeah,
last
the
year.
thing though is that the Atlantic 10 is better than people thought.
Yeah.
Even better than people thought. So I think that's what. But we digress. You know what, these two teams right now, you know, before this week, excuse me, before Monday night's Rutgers beat Monmouth handily, these two teams are going in opposite directions. Seton Hall clearly soaring. They're 8-1. Rutgers was kind of sputtering a little bit. They were 4-5, now 5-5. Where do they go? And they only have a couple games left each before the Big East. Where do they go now? Like, what do you see happening before they start conference play?
I think the path for Seton Hall is kind of straight line at this point.
Yep.
Their schedule is not very difficult. They'll get to the Big East play. I mean, unless Jordan Theodore and Herb Pope suddenly have a big drop in their play, they're going to get there, and I think they're going to get there without a loss. Rutgers is a little more difficult, mainly because I feel like you just don't know what you're getting from them. Like Dane Miller had a great line against Monmouth. He played tremendously, but he doesn't do it often enough or consistently enough. And with freshmen, you're never going to get consistency, I think.
Right.
So you really don't know what you're getting from Rutgers any given night. Can Dane Miller take that phone call from his grandmother, as you so well put in your game story, and kind of let it
Right.
charge him for the rest of the year? Because if he plays like that the rest of the year,
Oh,
now you have your stud. You have your stud to kind of
Eli
put on the
Carter said
back.
if he plays like that, no one beats us. Which they're right. I mean, you know, not no
He
one
he's
beats
the
them.
best defensive player in the Big East that way.
Yeah. He's
And
the best a lot of things in the Big East that
yeah,
way.
but you're not guaranteed to get that the rest of the way.
Right.
And that's why they're a 5-5 team. That's why they're going to be a roller coaster the entire year. And that's why Mike Rice is going to be angry and blow his top every single game.
Right. I mean, he was saying that David Cox, you know, like I put in the story of today's papers, that he asked, where's the button? Because we see it and it happens,
Right.
but why doesn't it happen all the time? And it's almost like he flips a switch and is like, you know what? Yeah, I want to be great and I want to dominate a game and then I'll do it. And then for 5 minutes, and then he's like, turns the lights off. It's like they're trying to find the button on Dane Miller that says go for 30 to 35
And
minutes.
it's so hard to find like how to incentivize college kids because you don't always know what they respond to. Here he responds
Right.
to something that's visceral and
Right.
it's his family. And it seems like he's not necessarily driven by greatness, you know, like a lot of players. They just want to be
Yeah,
great
he's
players.
told me that numerous times. He said, I don't care about scoring 25 points and being considered a
Right.
dominant
So
player.
now how do you figure out a way to drive him that way. How do you figure out a way to reach his visceral side, to reach into his heart, really?
Yeah. Is that on your word of the day calendar, by the way?
Viscerally? Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I'm trying to use a lot more big words now after reading Dave D. No. Although I do have to recommend, and this is completely off topic, please watch the Dave D. Mike Garofalo Giants video on NJ.com after the Cowboys.
I wasn't aware Dave D. got on video. So
I think this is the first
time. I thought
he
was pretty much like a vampire. Like, he doesn't appear on film.
He's kind of scared it steals his soul. Yeah. But anyone out there, watch it. All right, I digress.
We're going to Seton Hall. I mean, they're like you said, it's a straight line to where they need to go. I mean, their one test right now, assuming they don't have the colossal screw-up loss to a Longwood, a Mercer, or anyone, I think that's it. And, you know, their only game they need to win is at Dayton.
Yeah.
That's the only, they beat Dayton on the road, which is an incredibly difficult place to play, no matter how good or bad Dayton is. That is always a difficult place to play. If they beat Dayton, they go into Syracuse at 11-1. And you know what? If they somehow, you know, even if they lose to Syracuse, which will be the number one team in the country in all likelihood, they lose to Syracuse by, you know, say 12 or 13 and kept it close for most of the game, then maybe we're talking about Seton Hall program that, you know what, maybe they contend.
It's not out of the question. I mean, they got Brandon Mobley back today.
It's Mobley, by the way. I always thought it was Mobley, but it's Mobley.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. I'll take your word for it. That kind of just blows my mind after watching Patino Mobley play for but they get him back today, so that's another big for their rotation, which they desperately, desperately need. And the other guys, I really, that's the point of three out of those four games, except for the Dayton game, is figure out your rotation. Give them confidence, figure out their strengths and weaknesses, and then hopefully see how many of them can respond to the fire of playing at Dayton.
Yeah, yeah. And the first three games of their biggie schedule, they have to go at least 1-2. You know,
the three games are
You know, they are at Syracuse 3 days before New Year's Eve.
28th, yeah.
The 29th. Or excuse me, the 30th, they are home against West Virginia, and I believe
that's a winnable game. I think
that is a win. That's the one they have to get.
That's, I think, whoever gets the best of Kevin Jones and Herb Pope in that one wins that game.
Yeah, that's a good point. And then the big one is Connecticut a couple days after that, and they haven't beaten Connecticut since I think I was in second grade. So, you know what? You look at the onset. You have the number one team in the country, and what's Connecticut right now? Four, six.
I have the rankings here.
They're in the top 10. So, you know what? Chances are, if you looked on paper, Seton Hall is gonna lose probably two of those games. Now, if that's why West Virginia is so important, because you can't go 0-3 in the Big East, because then you are incredibly behind the eight ball. You have to. You're 1-2 in the Big East through those first three games, especially given how difficult they are. You're in good shape. You know, then they would be what? 11, they'd be 12-3.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty darn good start. 12-3 with wins over the win over with a win at Dayton, wins over St. Joe's, wins over VCU, Auburn, Wake Forest. I mean, it's not a murderer's row, but they're winning the games they're supposed to.
And I hate to kind of use a Bobby Gonzalez aphorism here, but it's all about what parts of the Big East schedule you're playing. They start out with a pretty tough slate. You know, they get through those three teams. You get number one Syracuse. You get West Virginia. You get number nine UConn or whatever they're ranked then. You get through that 1-2. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get through if you can kind of stay afloat through the difficult parts of your schedule and then rock the easier parts, that's how you get to be, you know, an 11-7. Or a 10-8.
Or even a 9-9.
Yeah.
I mean, 9-9 in this league still will, I think, get it done, despite how down the league has been so far. I still think 9-9 will get you in, depending on what the rest of your resume looks like. If you're 9-9 and played nobody,
the only problem is that, I mean, they're 11-1. If they're 11-1 coming into the Big East schedule, it's not a great 11-1.
Right, but they've played solid opponents. I mean, it's not like they've played, you know, 10
NJITs. They'll get to the magic 20 win mark coming into the tournament, and that
that's all that's all you need is you need 20 wins coming in 20 wins. I think at least 9 wins in the Big East, and then you got to get yourself at probably at least those first two games on the first 2 days, and then You know, if you can steal a third game, then I think you're in. I think that's the mathematic formula for Seton Hall.
And tell me if I'm crazy about this, but talking about, you know, Rutgers and Seton Hall for the next coming into conference play and
right.
what their prospects are. But what if going into the Big East play around February, Jordan Theodore, Herb Pope start to get tired because they're, you know, Atlas holding the entire team on their shoulders. And Rutgers, with all those freshmen, they kind of grow because of their youth and their inexperience leading into that point. And they gel, and Dane Miller maybe finds it upon himself
mm-hmm.
to just – he just decides he wants to dominate every
right.
time out, and he can do this. It's not out of the question that by February, Rutgers can be the better team.
No. That's certainly possible. I think my only thing is, and we saw this last year with Rutgers, seniors who are desperate tend to really be good.
Yeah.
And I think you're looking at two desperate seniors in Pope and Theodore. Do I think they're going to have a stretch where their tongues are hanging on the floor? Yeah, I do.
Because that's what I'm worried about for Seton Hall.
Yeah.
I mean, they just carry such a burden.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think what's helping them right now is that at least Fuquan Edwin is playing well and out is giving them what he needs to do. That's why I think they need to get, you know, either Cosby or Carlos started, because I think another guy can give Willard the flexibility and the confidence to say, all right, I can take Pope out for an extra minute or two, you know, or, you know, I don't have to, I can take Theodore out for an extra minute or two. I can give him maybe the extra, you know, break where, you know, maybe he's rested, you know, when, even though we're up 10 and the game's fairly in hand, you know, we don't have to play him the whole way through. We can rest him for the next game. You look at what those Rutgers seniors did, Jonathan Mitchell, James Beatty, Mike Coburn. No one believed that they could do it. And I think in their last chance, they said, you know what, yeah, we're probably not going to make the NCAA tournament, but we're going to make it a hell of a run, and we're going to give it a shot.
I'm wondering, do you think this is something Willard should do for three of the last four games, non-conference games? Goes to Jordan Theodore before the game and goes, all right, look, you're playing well. What I want you to do in these three games is make sure you're looking for Edwin, Carlos and Cosby the whole time. Make them your number one option, just so you can help grow them and prop them up.
I think you'll see that in you know Mercer, mm-hmm. Because it's a noon game. Mercer's, you know, not that good.
To
be
Mercer.
Frank, yeah, exactly. So I think you'll see that. The problem is that yeah, this is what's been the problem is they've actually tried to do that in certain games, and the freshmen don't make shots. So then, like, Seton Hall finds itself, you know, battling games against Yale and St. Peter's and St. Francis and NJIT, and then you got to play. Then you got to play those guys. So I think he'd actually rather get the, you know, Pope, Theodore, Edwin started, rely on Auto a little bit, and then, you know, build up a nice, you know, 13, 14, 15 point lead, and then start giving the freshmen some looks. Because then, like, you know, then if the freshmen miss, you know what, and it turns into a fast break and one the other way, well, you know what, you're still up 12 points as opposed to, you know, going from 6 to being up 3. Now it's a game.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all start to get tight, and then they got to realize that, you know, they're not part of the offense.
Hey, since we're running out of time, anything else around the Jersey area? Any local basketball that piques your interest?
I'm curious to see the you know, the outcome of the Ryder-Princeton game.
What's going on with Ryder and Tommy?
I don't know. Yeah, that's it's curious. I mean, they played really well at Pittsburgh, and then it's weird. I don't know what's up. And you know, Princeton played, you know, I mean, they're ugly, you know, at times, but you know, they played really well at Rutgers, and Ian Hummer's really good.
Yeah.
You know, if that I mean, you don't want to call a game so early in the season a knockout punch, but that might stagger them down to the map if Riders is in trouble as we think. How about yourself?
I was actually looking into that game as well.
Were you?
I thought Ryder could be, I mean, in the MAC, maybe the fourth team there.
Right.
The third team, maybe, if they had a good year. But, they start that horrible loss to Robert Morris.
Yeah.
And they play Pittsburgh to the wire. But then Drexel just kills them in the second half in that 6 a.m. game. And it just seems like they never found their footing, and they still haven't. And I really think that you need to get some confidence before you go into the MAC.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And I mean, Princeton, I'm not saying it's like an easy game, but that's a winnable game.
Absolutely. It's definitely a winnable game for that team. I mean, they're not lacking talent.
And I could see Princeton, if they win that one along with the win at Rutgers, they kind of gel.
And they
find themselves again for Ivy League play. And maybe,
you know,
maybe
it's a spark.
They become a contender there.
Right. Well, that will do it for us for this. I guess what do we call this? The unofficial fourth podcast since because of last week's disaster.
Yeah.
Podcast number four with an asterisk. We'll how about
Okay.
that? We will see you all here next week again. Thank you to our guest Dana O'Neill of ESPN.com. Go check her out if you haven't already, and we will catch you all next week. Take care.